The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning. I don't know if you've seen the movie Indecent Proposal. It's okay, Peter, I found it. Yeah, thanks, mate. I had lost something and Peter was trying to find it, but I found it. In the movie Indecent Proposal, which I finally got around to watching a couple of years ago, it's quite a disturbing and sad movie. The movie portrays a beautiful, loving couple. I think the man in it is an architect. I think when American movies want to make a story of a positive professional, they're often architects. I've just been noticing this pattern. I suppose it's because, yeah, but anyhow, there's a number of reasons it might be the case. But you know, they're a very desirable product. And, you know, he's with his childhood sweetheart. They really love each other. They spend time in the movie letting you know what a wonderful, joyful relationship this is. They've got financial problems. They come up with the brilliant idea to go and earn the money they need to pay off the mortgage and get the business on a secure footing by going to the casino, because we all know casinos are set up to help the needy. And surprise, surprise, they lose everything. Then Robert Redford walks in. He's a handsome guy. I can tell he's handsome. And he looks really smooth, and he likes the wife, Demi Moore, and he offers them this indecent proposal, which is to have a night with her for $1 million. They're in great financial need, so they feel. They both say no immediately, and then you see them awake at night thinking. And in the end, they begin to discuss, well, maybe we could do it. And in the end, they do. And in the end, of course, the tragedy is the whole relationship begins to unroll. And it's an indecent proposal. They're not forced into it. And I want to suggest to you today that Jesus makes what seems like an indecent proposal, but he also talks with us about another indecent proposal that we have before us. You heard read there some of the great questions that Jesus asks. It's been said by a man who I admire greatly, who's now old and grumpy. Not that everyone who becomes old becomes grumpy, but this man does seem to have become old and grumpy. Still brilliant. But years ago I heard him say this comment. He said, we've all got questions we want to ask God. But the really important questions are the questions that God asks us. The questions that we want to ask God are interesting, but the questions that God asks us are very important and ultimately usually unavoidable. So you may have noticed that once sin enters the story in the Bible, God begins to meet human beings with questions. So when he turns up in the garden to walk with Adam and Eve, and they're hiding, he says, Adam, where are you? There's no indication that he is puzzled. And then when he begins to dialogue with Adam, he says, have you eaten from the fruit of the tree which I told you not to eat? Again, not seeking information, but in I think what he's endeavouring to do is to engage Adam in conversation. When he talks to Cain, who's murdered his brother, he says, where is your brother? What is this that you have done? Question after question. To the great prophet Elijah, he says, how long will you go limping along with two opinions? Question after question after question. And Jesus asks many questions. And you can see them. The great one, which we're sort of focusing on today, is in verse 36 and again in verse 37. Jesus asks us, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what will a man give in exchange for his soul? I'm sorry that we've got an older translation that uses the word man for human. It's true of almost all great literature. It has to be apologized for now as our culture has moved on. But that's what it does. So here is Jesus. This passage actually begins, well, as always, you know, you can never quite get the context right without starting back at Genesis 1. But just if you go back up to the context here at verse 34, Jesus begins, I want to suggest to you, with an indecent proposal. And really an absurd proposal when you first look at it. Jesus summoned the crowd with his disciples. Now, I'm going to avoid the temptation to do the whole context thing. This is the third of three little discussions Jesus has. In the first one, he talks to the disciples. He asks them the question, who do you think I am? The second one, he outlines why he's come. They finally work out who he is. They've got to base one finally. It's taken them 8 chapters. Then, having worked out who he is, he then moves on to the question of why he's come to suffer. And then he turns, and here he calls the crowd, which is interesting, because the crowd hasn't heard the right answer about who Jesus is. And the crowd at this point hasn't come to any understanding that this great king comes in order to die, which is better than most kings who get their subjects to die for them. But he moves on with this question. He wants the crowd to understand this. He says, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Now, that's an entirely unattractive offer, isn't it? If I said to you, if any of you would like to become in the circle of my friends, which is what the idea of coming after me and be with me, if any of you would like to be my associates, if any of you would like to be involved with me, it's simple. Deny yourself, take up your cross. Now, once we unpack those in a second, you'll see what an absurd prospect that is. See, what Jesus says here is not to you, if you want to be one of his disciples, you need to learn some self-denial. I mean, all of us engage in self-denial. You may think it's a long suit of yours or a short suit of yours. But all of us, we do it with going to the bathroom. All sorts of things we say, I'd like to do it immediately, but I will wait for a little while. Some of us do self-denial with food. Some of us should do more self-denial with food, where you simply say, well, I won't do this because of that. This is not what Jesus says. He says not that you need to engage in some self-denial. He says, look at what he says. You need to deny yourself. That is to say, here's Ian with all his hopes and preferences and dreams and fears. I say no to Ian. So it really, what Jesus is saying, it's much bigger than self-denial. He's saying, you must say no to yourself. Right? So it really, in a real sense, you could say the ultimate sense, it matters not what Ian wants. That's not the question. Why? Well, I take it you can't follow Jesus with any freedom until you've said no to the other potential leader, which is yourself. So Jesus, if you want to follow me, you need to say no to yourself. Well, that's an attractive prospect. We spend much of our life trying to maximize our freedom so we can do whatever we feel like. And then he adds to the joy by saying this, you must take up your cross, which almost certainly that image means embrace a life of pain and shame and possible death. To take up the cross is what happens to a crucified, a convicted criminal, before they get crucified. And once you take up the cross legally, as I understand it in Roman law, you could not be pardoned. The crucifixion had begun, and it was just a question of how long. So Jesus says, I've got a proposal for you. Want to come with me? Simply say no to yourself and embrace a life of pain and shame. Oh, sign me up for that. It's a very attractive prospect. Now, why would anybody engage in that? Well, it all depends on what you think he's worth, doesn't it? But the interesting thing with Jesus is he is completely untrained in the ways of decent selling. So he maximizes the cost and really doesn't lay out here the benefits at all. Because he assumes that having looked at him over the 8 chapters, you'll get some sense of the wonder that it is to be caught up with him. So he gives a fairly tough call there. But then he assumes, I think, before he gets to verse 35, a recoil. And this is what he begins to deal with. Our natural recoil, saying, there's no way in the world that I'm saying no to myself. I don't mind, a few character adjustments. I can see I need some changes, some improving. I don't mind adding a spiritual dimension to an otherwise shallow life. But to completely just say no to me seems far too large. So then, because he knows there'll be a bit of recoil, he pushes on with verse 35. Whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. So if you say, well, I'm not going to say no to myself. I'm not going to execute myself. I'm going to keep my life safe. He says, if you keep your little life safe, if Ian Powell survives and lives, I lose him. Whoever loses his life, for my sake and the gospel, saves it. So Jesus says, if when you hear the invitation to follow me, you go, no, I'm not going to let myself go. I'm going to hang on to myself. I'm going to be the master of my own soul, the captain of my own destiny, etc. I'm not going to do that. She says, what you will find is that in hanging on to yourself, you lose yourself. In saving yourself, you perish. Then he asked the question, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? He moves into, well, he's already moved into economic terms. Uses of loss, profit, exchange is what he talks about here. And he says, let's talk about the sorts of deals you get offered. He says, if someone offers you the whole world in exchange for your soul, and I take it here, soul is parallel to the verse before. It says, your life, which Jesus says is only found in him. He says, if you get asked, you get offered, here's the whole world in exchange for yourself, for your soul, your true being, the part of you that, according to Jesus, will survive on beyond death. Now, I checked it up here that the gross domestic and national product, which are the same thing in this case, for the whole world in the year 2007 was a mere $54 million. And that's not even including the real estate, I think. That's just the buying and selling that goes on. So Jesus is saying, if you're offered $54 million, I always get confused at what a billion is nowadays, for your soul, bad deal. No deal, as the important television show says. No deal, right? So he's saying, if you offer the entire world in exchange for your soul, for your truest self, to give yourself away, to walk away from Jesus, who says, comes to bring life in its fullness, bad deal. And yet, when you think about the temptations we may have to walk away from living life Jesus' way, the overall general temptation which you may come to, the subtle go for this rather than that, or people that you may know who once were Christian and just in the business of making their living, etc., various pleasure options that came up, walk away, we normally will sell ourselves for substantially less than $54 million, I think. So people who I've known, as Jesus talks about when the seed begins to grow and the cares of life, the concern about wealth, etc., the weeds just grow in and choke the life out of the plant. What is that for normally? It's for a block of land, maybe with a harbour view. What's that, $2 million, $3 million bucks? You know, up, a bit more than that. Well, don't worry, in a few months you'll be able to pick them up cheap. That's my understanding of where we're going, but that's okay. So keep those $1 million cash and you can pick up some bargains. But, you know, it's a few $1 million bucks. School fees, life superannuation, $10 million bucks. We sell our soul for much, much less. We allow the weeds and the concerns in the end to strangle the life of God out of us for much, much less than that. And Jesus says, if you're offered the whole world for your life, your soul, that part in the kingdom of God, Jesus says, it's a bad deal. It's an indecent proposal to suggest to you that there is in any way this is worth doing. I remember I've had friends who've walked away. One man who walked away from his family and also from God in a relationship, a sexual relationship, which is much more than just pleasure. I know that. I think I used to think when people did that it was just about pleasure. I now realize that was very... It's much more than just pleasure. It's pleasure. It's not just physical pleasure, but it's all the relational and emotional stuff that goes with it. I remember saying to one man, you may want to suggest this is not the best spiritual counsel, but I remember saying to him, mate, I really hope the sex is fantastic. I hope it's the best sex ever on the planet, because it darn well better be, because it's going to cost you so much more. It'd be really a shame if it was second-rate sex, considering what you're paying for it in the end, in terms of your soul. Jesus says, what does it profit you if you gain the whole world but forfeit your soul? Verse 37, the question, what will a man give in exchange for his soul? And you'll know that there is a whole tradition of literature. There's an English version, there's a German version, there's a Polish version. The story of Faust. A discontented scholar, normally seen to be some sort of a scholar, who in the end makes a deal of some type with the devil to maximize his satisfaction. It normally involves a story of the seduction of a beautiful, nearly perfect woman, who in some of the stories is involved in his ultimate redemption. In some of the stories of Faust, he gets redeemed at the last minute. In some, he gets what he deserves. But this Faustian deal people talk about, where in order to experience life in its fullness, we make a deal in order to lose our soul, which is based on this sort of story, I think. What is it worth? It's not worth it. It's a bad exchange. Well, what are we like? Where is the reality of this for us? Well, the Australian dream has been said to consist of, well, depending on your class, the Holden, the home, and the holiday. Although, for some of us, it might be a Honda, maybe, because Hondas are slightly... The Honda, the house, and the holiday. The Australian dream, these things which must be attained at whatever cost. Or some have described it as treasure, leisure, and pleasure. I prefer the sort of spelling of it out as sap. You know how people say, we don't use the word often, a bit of a sap means you're a bit soppy, a bit weak, a bit silly. Sap standing for security, applause, and pleasure. Because I take it one of the key areas where we will sell our soul is actually for respect. Now, I don't know if this is as true for women as it is for men, but it is certainly true for men, that we will live and die for respect. C.S. Lewis has written a paper. If you've never read it, if you write me a note, I'll send you a copy of it, called The Inner Circle. And it's a speech he gives, he gave at some point in England, where he said, an enormous amount of evil is done by people's desire to get into the inner circle or to stay in the inner circle. And there was an inner circle. He said, it's often true that when you're in the inner circle, you're barely aware of it. It's when you're outside of it that you feel it. And he says, some of the worst evils have been done by people just trying to stay in the inner circle. That place of connection, that place of esteem, where you're treated with respect, you know you're winners. It's a magnificent piece of work, Lewis's insight on the inner circle. Men will often sell their souls. They will compromise things that matter, piece by little piece of the farm, in order to be on the inside, in order to be respected, in order to be esteemed. There are things that we won't say that we believe in. There are things that we will smile as if we find funny when we don't, in order to be accepted. Applause is actually an enormously powerful thing in our lives. Security is the other one. An enormous amount of our concern, our hard work, is not just to have, you know, more than enough, but it's just to have enough, or to what we feel is enough, to be secure, to be financially okay. And we extend that to include our family, our wives, our children, our husbands, whatever. But often that's just an extension of ourself. It's a way to justify how we want to make sure that we and all those attached to us will live. And I think very rarely do we sell our souls in one moment. It's normally a selling off of the farm piece by piece until finally you discover you've lost control. So King David, I didn't realize that when David has that horrible period of his life where he commits first adultery and then murder, I'd always pictured that David was just churning along, doing the right thing. But actually when you read the text, it was much more a slow leakage than a sudden blowout. He was already doing things that were clearly wrong for him as the king. The really obvious one is the army and the ark of the Lord is out there on the field. That's where he belonged. That's the king's job, is to lead the armies of Israel. He's back in the palace living it easy. So he has already decided that given the sacrifices he's already made for God, he doesn't need to be where he should be. Also, he's already got two wives. What's the significance of that? Well, in the book of Deuteronomy, the one person who is instructed to only have one wife is the king of Israel. You might know that, but the Bible doesn't actually think that it's a good thing to have many wives. But it's very clear that the king of Israel, unlike all the other ancient kings, one wife only. David already had two. So he's already cutting himself slack, and he's already being easy on himself. So when he sees this gorgeous woman, and he's a bit bored, and he's in a self-indulgent mood, it's a much smaller step than it would have been if this had happened to him 3-4 years earlier. And so it's often a slow movement away. That's why I think the most powerful part of that story Jesus tells about the seed that grows, the one that is most common, I think, in Sydney, is not that we give up because we're viciously persecuted. It's the weeds that grow up, isn't it? That just slowly choke the life out of the seed. And suddenly you wake up and there's just no real life or energy or dynamism or passion left in our relationship with God. We sell ourselves in pieces. I'll stop there. All sorts of other things that I would like to say, and some stories of people who I know have sold their souls, or people that I know have not sold their souls. I will finish with one. I'll move away from a lawyer to a man in the finances. I've got a great story here about a lawyer, but it's a true story. Young man I knew when I was at Shaw, a very impressive athlete. He reconnected with me about 6 years after he'd left the school. Turned up in my dream car, a beautiful little BMW sporty looking thing, which he decided he was going to get rid of. Because he said, when I bought this car, it said everything about myself I wanted to say. But now I don't want it. And I said, well, I want it. But he didn't give it to me. But here's the thing that happened to him. He'd sort of had a vague belief that Christianity was true for a long time and played around on the edges of Christianity for some time. Some stuff had happened. He'd gone and heard a speaker. He became a Christian on the Wednesday. On the Friday, he gets his license to practice in some area of finances. So the partners of the company took him out for dinner. They had it in the boardroom, and it was beautiful. And he said it felt good. He was sort of being welcomed into the club. But he'd also made his first deal where he sold, it was over $1 million worth of sales in one block of things. And so his peers, although they were all a fraction older than him, took him out for drinks, etc., on the Friday afternoon. So this is 2 days after he's committed himself to Jesus and said, okay, I'm going to say no to myself, I'm going to embrace the life of pain so that I may know you. And this is what happens. He's at this, it was at the Menzies. They're having drinks, and he's chatting with a couple of quite attractive-looking women, and he goes across to the bar to buy these women a drink. That's perfectly fine, I would have thought, for a Christian man to be the gentleman. When he's at the bar, a couple of the guys say to him, do you like the girls? He says, yeah, they're lovely. And they said, they're yours. He said, what do you mean they're mine? He said, well, they're hookers. We bought them for you. And he was a bit taken aback. And I think the temptation there is strong because he's already in relationship with them. Like, it's not just they've turned up out of the blue. Hey, we're hookers. That's a fairly straightforward thing to deal with. But he's already in the relationship, sort of a beginnings of a flirtatious, enjoyable relationship. And then they gave him a key with the room number on it. This is the old days. And they said, we've booked you a room. You don't need to go home. You can take them with you. And then when he told me, I thought, this is out of Wall Street, isn't it? And then they slipped him across a little container, and here's some cocaine, which will help the night go well. And having pushed him a little bit, come on, I said, come on, you're serious? I said, what did you do? Thinking that even as an old man, I think I would be in danger of collapsing under that sort of temptation. He said, I gently moved the keys back to the blokes, and I said, fellas, I appreciate the thought. I'm going home. He didn't even say goodbye to the gals. And I thought, there is no other way to survive, I would think, apart from that. Now, that's a bit like what Joseph did. But at that point, he's got a very blunt offer, hasn't he? And it's not just an indecent proposal because, you know, the girls aren't honest lawyers or something like that. But it's an indecent proposal because what he's being told, although the guy's doing it, I don't think know it, is you've got this Jesus thing going. Well, here's another offer. And he says, no. And that seems to me to be a man who has said, it won't profit me if I run down this road. It will be pleasurable. It will be the misuse of some of God's best gifts. I ain't going there. Because he's decided earlier he will deny himself, take up his cross, and follow. Well, I'll leave it there so we've got plenty of time for questions on this irrelevant topic to all of us. Three questions here. What are the chances of someone who has been slowly selling his soul returning to Christ? Substantial, I would have thought. I think at various times, I'm trying to think of where the Bible speaks like this, but certainly in terms of my experience and talking with friends, I think often people discover that they have been sacrificing in the area of their life as a Christian in order to pursue either treasure, leisure, or pleasure. And they think, oh, I've begun to, as it were, take money out of this account in order to support this account, and think, I must change. I think when Jesus talks to the church in Laodicea, who think they're so fantastic, you know, they think, you know, he says, you think you are rich, you are prospered, you need nothing, you do not realize that you are poor, naked, pitiable, and blind. He says, you know, he says, the call is to come back to him. And so I think the Bible assumes that there's often this movement where we are pulling back in our commitment to Christ. There's a tendency I've noticed at that point to become very critical of Christians who are keener. I was chatting with a man at a church I was speaking at some years ago, and I was delighted to have a chance to talk with him, because he said he was working as an engineer, and he was doing business with a particular company, and they just gave him a number of little cash benefits just to make sure that they kept getting the contract to sell. And he talked to his boss, look, they just offered me this sort of, you know, and the boss said, he said, it's okay to take it because we're going to use them anyhow. So, you know, it really isn't going to change anything, and it's, why not? And he said it began for him about 2 years where he got increasingly angry with Christians. And he said in the end, he stopped going to church. A few things happened that brought him back to God. And he realized what had happened was that at the point when he began to do what was clearly evil, what he knew as a Christian he shouldn't do, in fact, even as a decent human being he shouldn't have done, it began to make him uncomfortable in the presence of God and his people. So he became the arch critic and began finding, you know, constantly thinking what jerks they were. And eventually he was brought back through some nasty incidents. So can someone come back? Absolutely. There's a secondary question related to that. What advice do you have for people who started selling themselves? I would think one of the key things is to find a Christian brother or sister. If you're a man, get a brother. If you're a woman, get a sister. And begin to talk with them honestly. And you may need to look around for one who you can be honest with and who will be honest back with you. I think it's secrecy is the area where as a man said to me once, he said, on my own I can convince God of nearly anything. And of course what he's saying is I can convince myself that God's okay. You need to have a brother or a sister who will speak with you honestly. I think that's one of the key things. So I don't know if you've got, the Bible speaks of the wounds of a friend. I hope you've got some Christian friend, if you are a Christian, who you invite into your life to speak to you honestly. And you give them, as it were, the sense that if they challenge you about an important thing in your life, that you're not going to say, you should look at yourself, you filthy judgmental creep, which is what we tend to do. And see, the person who comes to you with a word of critique may be a filthy judgmental creep, but it's worthwhile listening to them anyhow, because God can speak through filthy judgmental creeps. So I think in the end, I would think one of the key things is to, the continual reading of the Bible is of course one of the great keys, but to have in place a relationship with someone who you give permission to challenge you. How does deny myself and take up my cross, being required to follow Jesus, fit in with where Jesus says that we should come to him because his burden is easy and his yoke is light? You know, it's not my job to try and make sense of these things really, but it is clear that Jesus says at one point, he paints pictures of being Christian that are harsh and hard and difficult, where he sounds as if he's almost discouraging people from following him. So there's a part in Luke's gospel where he has interaction with three people about becoming Christians. And a couple of them offer to follow, and he sounds as if he's saying, no, don't. You're not up for it. So sometimes Jesus will say, in order to follow me, it's going to cost you all you got. Other times he says, those who are needy and weary and thirsty and hungry, come to me. Both are true. When I became a Christian, what I was confronted by was the harsh business of, there's Ian's life going along quite happily, and what Jesus is saying is that whole way of life has to die. That the kingdom of Ian has to be utterly overthrown, and that kingdom has to come under the kingdom of Jesus. Now that for me was a it was a power struggle, really, between me and him. What I discovered, and it was a huge surprise, that it is true, that his burden is easy and his yoke is light. That actually when I place myself under him, it's a bit like the fish that had been worked on for many years by scientists and until it was completely frightened of water, and they'd even done shock therapy with it to make it hydrophobic. And it was a masterpiece. But in the end, one day it accidentally fell in some water and it panicked and it was terrified. It was desperately trying hard not to breathe. But in the end, it sucked in water and discovered its gills and flicked its tail and discovered, hey, this isn't going to kill me. And I think I was a bit like that when I became a Christian. It was like, deny yourself in, take up your cross, be willing to endure, suffer pain and discomfort. And then you discover, but his burden is easy and his yoke is light. I don't really understand how the two work together. But I think both realities need to be kept in mind. And sometimes the step in becoming Christian or the step in moving forward as a Christian seems to be nothing other than blood and pain. That it will cost you shame, it will cost your reputation. I think it's true, if I remember the story of Chuck Colson properly, who was one of President Nixon's men, and had managed to, because he was a clever lawyer, he was able to cover his trail, so it seemed as if he would stay out of trouble, that when he became a Christian, he went to the police and confessed what he'd done, and therefore went to jail. The way that the media will sometimes portray it is that, you know, having gone to prison in trouble, he became... As I remember the story, it's not like that at all. That he became a Christian and then realized part of being Christian would be being honest and paying up for what he'd done. Therefore, he goes to prison. I don't imagine it was an easy choice for a wealthy, privileged man to do. But as he says himself, he's now dead. That was the beginning of the real excitement of his life. So I think in the end, both things are true. Can I finish? I've got time to finish with one other a true story, one that really inspired me some years ago. A young sort of lawyer who works in tax advice. Are these such creatures? They seem like an overlap between highbrow accountants, etc. But this is the area he worked. He worked for a large company, which I won't mention the name of. And he was actually called to a board meeting, which is unusual. He was the sort of financial guru. Because some of the members of the board had heard there was a way of organizing their tax that could save the company millions. And he was asked to come and have some sort of a conversation, which was unusual. Gets called to the meeting, and they outline what some of these guys had heard that other companies in the similar area of retail as them were doing. And they said, could you do it? He said, well, yes and no. They said, explain. He said, well, I know how to do it, but I'm not going to do it. And they said, why not? Well, he said, because it's crystal clear that the law is trying to stop that. That acts have been passed in order to not let that happen. So he said, although there are ways to get around it, it's perfectly clear that's what we will be doing. And I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to use my capacities to do that. And there was quite a nasty standoff at that point between him and some of the members of the board. Now, the reason he was doing it, as he says, was because he had recently become a Christian and understood at that point he should be a man of integrity and honesty rather than a man of deep deceit and sneakiness. And he was a young man, house in the expensive suburb north of Sydney near the water, young wife, a couple of kids in private schools. I mean, it's the full catastrophe he's got going. If he loses his job, and I presume it would not be easy to get a similar job if he lost his job in that sort of situation, he's going to have a hard time with his wife, if nothing else. And yet he makes the stand. Now, as it turns out, the story works out okay for him. The company, he actually persuaded the company not to go down that road, which was better for the Australian taxpayer, etc., etc. But it's that sort of thing where he could have said, shrugged his shoulders and moved in an area. Now, whether or not you think what he was doing is right or wrong, I'll leave that to you to work out the ethics as lawyers. I'm not a lawyer. But for him, he sensed that would be wrong. The pressure on him would have been to sell a bit of his soul, to compromise in what he believed God wanted him to do in favour of what would have looked after his treasure and his leisure and his pleasure, etc. And it's that sort of stance where I think we need to hear the call of Jesus. What does it profit you in the end if you gain the whole world but lose your soul? Well, I hope that's of some use and isn't directly relevant today, but you never know when you get hit with those absolute career-determining or eternity-determining choices and options.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.